South Korea says the North is preparing for a nuclear test, with the U.S. warning it could happen during President Biden's visit to Seoul this week. The military wing of Palestine's Islamic Jihad movement declares its readiness to confront the Israeli regime in all territories. And the UN Secretary General warns about years of mass hunger and famine as the war in Ukraine worsens the global food crisis. Hello and welcome. It's good to have you with us. The South Korean lawmaker warns that North Korea is ready to conduct a nuclear test at any moment. Following a briefing by the National Intelligence Service, the lawmaker talked about the completion of Pyongyang's preparations for a nuclear test, adding they're only looking for the right time. Meanwhile, the United States has warned that a possible nuclear test could happen while President Joe Biden is in Seoul this week. This is going to be Biden's first trip as president to Asia, and the U.S. intelligence says it's possible the North Korean leader Kim Jong-un would stage a provocation after Biden arrives in Seoul late Friday. The U.S. and North Korea have been locked in a standoff over Pyongyang's missile and nuclear tests, which the White House describes as provocative. But the North argues it needs them to protect itself from America. The Al-Quds Brigades, which is a military wing of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement, says its forces are ready for confrontation with the Israeli regime. The resistance group says it's prepared for a war with Tel Aviv in the Gaza Strip, Jenin, or other parts of the occupied territories. It's pledged to continue resistance until the liberation of all Palestinian land. According to Al-Quds Brigades, resistance has grown stronger and more equipped in the past year and is ready to repel any Israeli attack. Israeli forces have, in recent months, escalated their raids on the Al-Aqsa Mosque as well as the occupied West Bank. The atrocities have led to widespread protests. UK-based pro-Palestine activists group has taken the fight to Israel's biggest arms manufacturer in Britain by launching a series of direct action protests at sites belonging to the drone producer Elbit Systems. Palestine Action have vowed further action in response to the ongoing support Elbit provides the Israeli regime in oppressing innocent Palestinians. Robert Carter reports.
A UK-based Israeli arms manufacturer has been hit with a series of disruptive direct action protests in retaliation to recent Israeli aggression against Palestinians. Palestine Action have intensified their long-running campaign against Elbit Systems, with activists trashing sites in London and Bristol.
Elbit Systems is a notorious Israeli arms manufacturer with locations dotted all across the UK. Their HQ is a popular target for Palestine Action, who claim that their activities is focused on disrupting their production activities. Elbit is known for producing up to 85% of Israel's drone fleet, after all.
Israeli crimes against Palestinians has circulated world headlines in recent weeks, particularly surrounding the killing of journalist Shireen Abu Akhila, shot dead by Israeli regime forces as she documented an Israeli assault on a Palestinian refugee camp on the 11th of May. The killing occurred just days before the Nakba, an annual date which marks the ethnic cleansing of native Palestinians from their homeland. Elbit's recent response stated,
Elbit Systems UK is proud to provide advanced support for the UK armed forces. Attempting to disrupt this work during a time of heightened global instability is dangerous and highly irresponsible.
However, the activists rubbish Elbit's stance.
How many lives have they saved compared to how many lives they've taken, would be my question. They are responsible for so many deaths of men, women and children. How could you possibly think that that's in any way security? It's illegal, it's a crime. All of these things are criminal, and yet it's when you're out there doing something that you're shown as the criminal, essentially. And I've always found that very interesting as a narrative.
With Palestine Action vowing to continue and Israel's occupation persisting, many expect to see more spilling of red paint, but also more Palestinian blood too. Robert Carter, London.
The Secretary General of Lebanon's Hezbollah movement has hailed the results of the country's parliamentary elections as a great victory for the resistance front. Sayed Hassan Nasrallah says the gains of Hezbollah and its allies in the elections show the people support the resistance and want it to keep its weapons. He also praised the Lebanese people for their massive participation in the electoral process, despite all the economic, social, and political upheavals in the country. Nasrallah said the voters' enthusiasm and turnout showed they didn't care about 3 years of media campaign to boycott the vote. Hezbollah and its allies have won 62 seats in the 128-member assembly. 13 seats have also gone to independent candidates who have yet to choose a bloc. The United Nations envoy on the impacts of sanctions has wrapped up her 10-day visit to Iran. Her trip was aimed at assessing the human rights violations caused by the United States sanctions on Iran. Our correspondent, Yusuf Jalali, reports.
A witness to the humanitarian consequences of U.S. sanctions on Iran, Alina Duhan is the U.N. Special Rapporteur on the negative impact of the unilateral coercive measures on the enjoyment of human rights. On her 10-day trip to Iran, she paid a visit to 30 ministries and institutions to assess how the U.S. sanctions have affected different sectors in Iran. She described the sanctions on Iran as devastating and inhumane.
Economic challenges arising from unilateral sanctions and lack of international cooperation based on shared responsibility prevent the government of Iran from providing sustainable assistance to the most vulnerable categories of population.
In her exclusive interview to Press TV, the UN rapporteur spoke about her observations in Iran, saying the Iranian people are bearing the brunt of U.S. sanctions.
The darkest part of all that is the fact that all population of the country, regardless of the nationality, is affected by the use of sanctions, even the nationals of countries which impose sanctions. And Iranians abroad are affected. And I believe it's even worse that imposition of these comprehensive sanctions delivers the feeling of fear.
To many Iranian patients, sanctions are an unending nightmare, barring them from accessing life-saving medicine. Hundreds of thalassemia patients and people with EB, among others, are grappling with drug shortage in Iran. Many of them have died because of this problem.
Well, the United States argues that its sanctions do not target Iran's health sector directly. But the sanctions on its banking system have made it complicated for the country to purchase medical items. Does this amount to an escape route for the U.S. to shrug off its responsibility over the existing problem in Iran's health sector?
I see here two problems. So point number one, that when it comes to the banking sector, there are no proofs that they are legal. Basically, they are illegal. There are no grounds to impose these sanctions, and it's already a problem by itself. And the humanitarian impact of banking sector sanctions has been illustrated in the report and will be illustrated in more details. When it comes to the health sector, naturally there is a general license issued by OFAC entitling for humanitarian exceptions in the health area. However, in reality, it's nearly not possible. It's not possible because of the number of issues. The very first one to deliver humanitarian goods, you still need to get OFAC license in many of the cases. And getting OFAC license is very lengthy. You need to consult lawyers or people who used to deal with OFAC license. Responses come within several years.
Alina Duhan started her mandate as a UN rapporteur in March 2020. Ever since, she has paid similar visits to four other countries, including Zimbabwe and Venezuela. UN rapporteurs are appointed by the UN as freelancers and are not affiliated to and paid by the UN. That's why Ms. Duhan promised that her report will not be influenced by politics.
Ms. Duhan cited countless instances of the humanitarian side effects of U.S. sanctions on Iran, dismissing the move as a tool to achieve political gains. Tehran now views Ms. Duhan as an independent and internationally endorsed witness to the issue, urging her to report it as it is to the UN Human Rights Council. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The impact of harsh U.S. sanctions against the Iranian people has been under the spotlight again on social media after UN Special Rapporteur Alina Duhan admitted that the bans are illegal and violate human rights principles.
Hey, what is going on, everyone? Welcome to another Hashtag Trending with me, Ali Reza. Social media users have been engaged in a renewed debate on the suffering of the average Iranian under draconian U.S. sanctions in the wake of a recent report by an independent UN expert on the impact of these sanctions. On an official visit to Iran, UN Special Rapporteur Alina Duhan censured the United States for its brutal sanctions against Iran. She also said that the impact of these illegal U.S. sanctions on Iranians have been, quote-unquote, devastating, and she called on Washington to remove them. Many questioned the American claims that the sanctions have been smartly designed against the Iranian government. They say that, contrary to those claims, average Iranian citizens have proven to be the prime target of these sanctions that also block the imports of medicine, medical equipment, and other essential items. Let's read our first tweet of the day coming from No Sanctions on Iran. UN Special Rapporteur confirms what we have known all along, that the sanctions have crippled the economy and have most impacted those with, quote, severe diseases, disabled people, Afghan refugees, women-led households, and children, end quote. Reza Majzadeh said that the UN Special Rapporteur condemned the harsh effects of sanctions on people's health. There is no smart sanctions. It causes suffering. Fereshte Sadeghi has our next tweet. UN Special Rapporteur, sanctions impact vulnerable groups, heads of household, stop international agencies from providing humanitarian aid due to difficulties in transfer of money. Sanctions exacerbate the situation, interfere in ordinary life, violate humanitarian laws. The visit to Iran by the Special Rapporteur was the first of its kind since 2005, and many praised her for confirming the truth about the devastating impacts of the sanctions on the life of Iranians, which does not even spare innocent children and will negatively impact future generations. Our next batch of comments starts with one by Atiya. Anyone with two brain cells would know how these sanctions are devastating and criminal. All those who deny it know this very well and are complicit in this crime against humanity. Hashtag Iran. ODVV said unilateral coercive measures as punishment violate international human rights standards. At Elena Duhan also said, adding that putting sanctions on companies that had trade relations with Iran and the imposition of secondary sanctions is illegal. Koldo Kasla has our next tweet. Economic sanctions affect future generations. UN 2006 on Iran sanctions decreased children's total years of schooling, and the probability of attending college went down by 4.8%. Households reduced education spending by 58%, particularly on school tuition. And here we have a comment by Kong. The U.S. should be ashamed of what it did and immediately lift illegal sanctions on Iran. Some blasted the U.S. administration for failing to rejoin the 2015 Iran deal, which would lift the coercive sanctions against Iran. They also blasted Washington's Western and Middle Eastern allies who support these sanctions that are devised not only to exert pressure on Iran and Iranians, but also to exert pressure on all other nations who are seeking independence. Our final batch of comments starts with a tweet by True Democracy. Biden could have issued an executive order on day one of his presidency to rejoin the JCPOA, but he didn't. That's when Iran realized that they are who they are dealing with. Even if Biden rejoins the JCPOA, the U.S. will find a way to continue to make the Iranian people suffer through sanctions. And here we have some comments on Press TV's website. NA said, Iran should go its own way regardless of any sanctions. Don't rely on any fake organization like the UN, etc. You have managed it proudly for more than 40 years, and nobody is able to break your iron will if it takes another 40 years. The history of Iran should prevail as a great nation forever. Jay wrote on Press TV's website, America, the biggest abuser of human rights, claims to support human rights by sanctions, bombing, destruction, stealing, and how much longer humanity can tolerate these genocides before ending these tragedies? Even the International Criminal Court, the ICC, has been threatened by America and is currently under America's sanctions. Final comment comes from Soul of Persia. Sanctions are war crimes. They deliberately and specifically target a non-combatant civilian population. The US, UK, EU, and their Zionist masters in apartheid Israel are guilty of the death and suffering of immeasurable life in Iran, Cuba, Korea, Venezuela, Yemen, Syria, Iraq, Palestine, Afghanistan, Somalia, Zimbabwe, Vietnam, Nicaragua, and many other nations on our planet spanning the last few decades, with further crimes taking place by imperialist states in the decades before. That's been it for another edition of Hashtag Trending. Let's head back to the studio for the rest of the world news.
Welcome back. The UN Secretary General has warned about years of mass hunger and famine if no steps are taken to contain a global food crisis worsened by the war in Ukraine.
Russia must permit the safe and secure export of grain stored in Ukrainian ports. Alternative transportation routes can be explored, even if we know that by itself they will not be enough to solve the problem. And Russian food and fertilizers must have unrestricted access to world markets without indirect impediments. I have been in intense contact on this issue at the senior leadership level with the Russian Federation, Ukraine, Turkey, the United States, the European Union, and several other key countries. I am hopeful, but there is still a long way to go. The complex security, economic, and financial implications require goodwill on all sides for a package deal to be reached.
Antonio Guterres was addressing a food security meeting at the UN. He said the war in Ukraine is compounding global food insecurity amid warming temperatures and the coronavirus pandemic. The UN chief said the number of severely food insecure people has doubled from 135 million to 276 million in just 2 years. Guterres said the war in Ukraine threatens to tip tens of millions of people over the edge into food insecurity. The war and economic sanctions on Russia have increased global prices for food and fuel, especially in developing countries. Russia and Ukraine account for nearly a third of global wheat supplies. Russia says nearly 700 more Ukrainian fighters have surrendered in the Azovstal steelworks, their last holdout in the city of Mariupol. That brings to 960 the number of forces in the plant who have put down their weapons after being trapped there for over 2 months. However, Moscow says some 1,000 Ukrainian troops, including top commanders, are still fighting in Mariupol. The city is the biggest Russia has so far captured in a war that began on February the 24th. And with that, we'll come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Majh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common. This is a part of the speech delivered on April 29, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of Quds Day. In the first part of this speech, Imam Khamenei expressed his gratitude for the Iranian nation for their participation in Quds Day. In the name of God, the Beneficent, the Merciful, all praise is due to God, Lord of the worlds, and peace and greetings be upon our Master Muhammad and upon his pure household, especially the remnants of God on earth. Greetings to the great Iranian nation, who has created an epic in the literal sense of the word today. Greetings be upon our late magnanimous Imam, who was the architect of this auspicious foundation for eternity. As far as I know, and according to what I have witnessed today, the presence of the people throughout the country has been an epic turnout in the pure sense of the word. It was magnificent. The people entered the arena with complete motivation. This great movement of the people is something big and is a blessing. Your presence in the political and public areas of defending Quds is a true defense of Quds. This is a true defense. Those who are defending Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque, the first Qibla, direction for prayer of the Muslims, with their bodies and souls will be encouraged with your movement. They will gain energy and become more resistant, and with God's grace, the Palestinian cause and the great Palestinian fight is close to its final conclusion, which will be a blessed conclusion, God willing.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Today, I will speak about certain points about Quds and Palestine with our dear Palestinian brothers, and I will say this part in Arabic. I have spoken at length about this matter with our own people many times. Today, I wish to address the Palestinian brothers and the entire world of Islam, in particular our Arab brothers. In the name of God, the Beneficent, the Merciful, all praise is due to God, Lord of the worlds, and peace and greetings be upon the Master of all humanity and the most honorable human being, our Master Muhammad al-Mustafa, the last messenger, upon his immaculate progeny, upon his chosen companions, and upon those who follow them until the day of judgment. Greetings to all Muslim brothers and sisters throughout the world. Greetings to the youth of the world of Islam. Greetings to the courageous, zealous youth of Palestine, and upon all the people of Palestine. Once more, Quds Day has arrived. Holy Quds calls all Muslims in the world. The truth is that as long as the surprising criminal Zionist regime is dominating over Quds, all days of the year should be considered to be Quds Day.
You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
On Saturday, a gunman attacked a supermarket in Buffalo, New York, killing 10 people and injuring 3 others. Most of the victims were African American, making the attack one of the deadliest racially charged mass shootings in the United States' recent history. According to the police, the detained suspect, identified as 18-year-old Peyton Gendron, drove over 200 miles to carry out the attack. The law enforcement also said they were reviewing a 180-page document published online detailing the gunman's motivations. In the so-called manifesto, the author describes themselves as a white supremacist concerned about, quote, the dwindling white population. The document also says that he chose the area for the attack as its zip code has a large black population, which was within the driving distance of where he lived.
the inability of the unsustainability of neoliberal capitalism. So there's less resources, there's scarcity, there's a job market is being affected. Everyone is affected by that, but their interpretation of what the problem is different. And for white extremists, white supremacist extremists, they blame immigrants, they blame black people, they blame. And so you're seeing these ideologies that are emerging, or mentalities, or not emerging. They've always existed, but they're responding to the intensification of the logical conclusions of neoliberalism and neoliberal capitalism, austerity, joblessness, you know, privatization, all of that.
The police are investigating the attack as a hate crime, as an act of racially motivated violent extremism. The teenager faces first-degree murder, a charge he has pleaded not guilty to. Among the victims were a father who was buying a birthday cake for his 3-year-old son, and Catherine Massey, a 72-year-old woman who was known for her civil rights advocacy. The tragic irony is that almost a year ago, she had written a letter to a local newspaper calling for stricter gun control measures. The Buffalo mass shooter managed to live stream his attack on a popular streaming service using camera gear mounted on his military helmet. Although the feed was taken down soon after it began, the issue reignited criticisms about the moderation of social media platforms. It bore striking similarities with the 2019 terrorist attack on two mosques in the city of Christchurch in New Zealand that killed 51 people. That attack was also streamed live on social media. The incident in Buffalo is considered the deadliest mass shooting in the U.S. so far this year. But some 200 other mass shootings were carried out since the beginning of January. Unofficial data suggests that over 320 people are shot in the U.S. every day. A recent report by the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention showed that gun violence in the country rose dramatically in 2020, with homicides involving firearms surging by 35%, the highest level in 25 years. The report points to disparities in the rates of homicide based on race, ethnicity, and poverty. This study fails to single out the specific reason for such inequality, but cites the COVID-19 pandemic as a possible socioeconomic driving factor.
People having to seek their own interpretations of what's happening. We're seeing it like things like this shooting, and this is not the only shooting. There's other things that are happening where people are acting out, trying to figure out, you know, just acting out, reactionary, the most extreme reactionary responses to what's happening. And it can only get worse. As long as capitalism and white supremacy and patriarchy are the rule of the day in the United States, they can't address the fundamental human needs of people, then things like this will get worse. And then as the media glosses over it and doesn't want to tell people the truth, they can only get worse.
Tragic incidents like these are a grim reminder of the need for tighter gun control laws that would prevent easy access to firearms and reforms that would rid the U.S. society of racial and ethnic biases.
Okinawa, a Japanese island in the Western Pacific Ocean. The island was the scene of one of the fiercest battles of the Pacific War. It has marked the 50th anniversary of the end of U.S. occupation and its return to Japanese sovereignty after 27 years of U.S. rule. Okinawa returned to Japan on May 15, 1972. However, the island chain still hosts the majority of American military bases in Japan. It harbors about 70% of the U.S.'s military bases in Japan and more than half of its 47,000 troops. Many Japanese people, particularly Okinawans, are against the continued heavy American military presence and are protesting to draw attention to the issue.
Far from being reduced as people in Okinawa demand, the U.S. military bases have even been strengthened instead. We hope the rally will help people in the prefecture and in other places realize the seriousness of the issue.
The presence of U.S. troops in Japan is not in any way intended to protect Japanese citizens, but a part of U.S. military strategy. Frequent incidents caused and crimes committed by U.S. troops in Japan only make Okinawa more dangerous.
Hundreds of protesters from across Japan have staged rallies in Okinawa demanding a reduction of U.S. military forces in the prefecture. In the city of Naha, more than 1,000 people from Tokyo, Hiroshima, Nagasaki, as well as Okinawa held an indoor gathering to call for peace and to oppose U.S. bases. Japanese locals on Okinawa have already been expressing serious opposition to the presence of U.S. forces on the island. A poll by the Asahi Shimbun newspaper and Okinawan media organizations found that 61% of local people wanted fewer U.S. bases on the island, while only 19% said they were happy with the status quo. Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida, who promised to make a greater effort to reduce hosting U.S. military bases in the region, also acknowledged the issue as well as the economic inequalities that still make Okinawa one of the country's poorest areas.
50 years have passed since Okinawa's reversion to Japan, and the people of Okinawa still bear a heavy burden from the U.S. bases. The government takes this very seriously and will continue to do the utmost to reduce the burden from the bases.
A string of tropical islands located off far southwest Japan, Okinawa, has suffered massive devastation in World War II. Fierce battles between Japanese and American forces left as many as one-third of its people dead. Then around 30 years of U.S. rule followed. And Japan has not forgotten those days. Despite their opposition to U.S. troop presence, Okinawans are more concerned about the threat of a military confrontation involving China. Okinawa is closer to Taiwan than the capital, Tokyo. This could turn it into a target to be the front line in case of a conflict between the U.S. and China. Beijing considers Taiwan as its territory and views U.S. military provocations as a sign of support for those inside Taiwan who seek independence. American warships periodically carry out voyages through the strategic Taiwan Strait, drawing angry responses from China. The U.S. is also the island's key backer and main arms supplier. Tensions in Okinawa are likely to rise further given that lawmakers in the ruling Liberal Democratic Party have said that they want a commitment to more defense spending, including missiles that can hit targets on foreign soil. Missiles that could be deployed on Okinawa.
The United States uses its force and uses its bullying tactics to impose its will on other countries. So I don't know that in the minds of the Japanese government that they are really able to operate as totally sovereign, independent entities when it comes to going against the interests of the United States.
Considering the latest developments, Okinawa could soon find itself in the middle of another conflict, one that is reminiscent of a dark point in its history. And this time again, Washington plays a role in it. On May 15, 1948, the Zionist regime forced some 750,000 Palestinians to leave their homes and villages and expelled them into refugee camps that still exist in the occupied West Bank, Gaza, Jordan, Syria, and Lebanon. Armed Zionist forces massacred entire villages of men, women, and even children. That pushed rightful owners of Palestine to leave their homes and lands as they feared losing their lives. Consequently, that provided the ground for Zionists to establish the Israeli regime. The Palestinians were to suffer further when the West Bank and Gaza fell to the Israelis during the 1967 war, also known as the Six-Day War. Millions of Palestinians, including those displaced since 1948, found themselves under military occupation as well as further Israeli expansionism in their lands. Palestinians want the West Bank as part of a future independent Palestinian state, with East al-Quds as its capital. But Israel's settlement expansion and annexation plans have dealt a serious blow to any prospects of peace. The Gaza Strip has also been under an inhumane Israeli land, air, and sea siege since 2007, and witnessed three wars since 2008. More than 600,000 Israelis currently live in over 230 settlements built since the 1967 Israeli occupation of the West Bank and East Al-Quds. That's while all Israeli settlement activities are illegal under international law. Every year, Palestinians reaffirm their right to return to their homes and villages in historic Palestine on Nakba Day. They hold annual rallies to commemorate decades of ethnic cleansing of their homeland by the Zionist regime to establish what's known today as Israel. This year, thousands of Palestinians and their supporters across the globe have taken to the streets to hold mass rallies in commemoration of the 74th anniversary of Nakba, or Catastrophe Day, and to condemn the recent killing of a veteran Palestinian journalist by Israeli forces. Shirin Abu Aghla was fatally shot by Israeli troops as she was covering an army raid on the Jenin refugee camp in the northern part of the occupied West Bank. Targeting the media organizations and journalists isn't an accident. This is systematic targeting of media to create a cloak of secrecy around Israeli crimes.
This is something that is extremely important because it is the part of the historical memory of a culture and people who have been subjugated by an illegal occupation of an apartheid regime.
In an expression of solidarity with the people of Palestine, the Iranian Foreign Ministry stated that addressing the issue of Palestine should be the first and foremost issue for the Muslim world, saying any attempt by global Zionism to drive the issue into oblivion would be doomed to failure. The Iranian ministry also stated that the anniversary of Nakba puts on display the failure of international institutions and organizations to resolve one of the longest-running humanitarian and political crises in the world. Israel has managed to get away with its crimes for decades as it enjoys Washington's unwavering support. The U.S. provides the regime with billions of dollars in lethal aid every year. It also invariably uses its veto power at the United Nations to block the world body's anti-Israeli resolutions.
Well, I think that the complicity of basically the Western political class in its entirety and the media in the West is inseparable from the question of Israeli impunity. Israel knows full well that it can do whatever it wants, that it can kill journalists, that it can kill Palestinian children, that it can continue with administrative detention and systematic torture of Palestinian prisoners, and that they'll get away with it because they will never be sanctioned by any of the so-called Western democracies.
This has quietly encouraged the Tel Aviv regime to continue violating the rights of Palestinians and to displace them and to steal their land. But how long will the regime of Tel Aviv be able to extend its illegal existence through carnage and plunder? Former Israeli Premier Ehud Barak has expressed concern about Israel's survival, saying the entity will cease to exist before the 80th anniversary of its 1948 establishment. The ultra-conservative former premier's comments echo prevailing fears in the occupied territories. A recent survey of young Israeli adults found that nearly half of the population in the occupied Palestinian territories is not optimistic about Israel's future, with more than one-third of people thinking about migrating for jobs and better life. Many analysts have pointed to the theory of collapse from within regarding the future of Israel, citing three factors of economic crisis, poor security situation, and social divisions for the imminent decline and fall of the regime.
On Wednesday, two journalists covering an Israeli raid on the occupied West Bank city of Jenin for Qatari broadcaster Al Jazeera came under attack. Ali al-Samoudi was shot in the back but survived. His colleague, Shirin Abu Akleh, however, wasn't as lucky. The reporter was shot in the head and was pronounced dead after being rushed to the hospital. The attack came despite them both wearing vests with the word press emblazoned on them.
It wants the image of absolute lawlessness and operating with impunity. What could be more criminal than the targeted assassination? And just to say how strongly the whole world feels and the outrage at the assassination of Shirin Abu Akleh.
Also, according to eyewitnesses, the attack was unprovoked as there was no confrontation between Palestinians and the regime's forces at the time of the assault on the journalists.
The occupation is murderous and criminal. They shot us for no reason. We, a group of journalists, were there wearing our full press uniform in addition to the helmets with the word press written in large letters, as big as the whole world. We were obvious. We made sure to walk right in front of the army patrols so that they can see us, and they saw us after we went to a road where there were no armed people, no civilians, and there were no shooting and no incidents there. We were shocked by the shooting. I was lucky and I turned my back when the first bullet was shot and injured my back. They wanted to kill me. I was injured in my back and the second bullet shot my colleague Shirin and caused her death.
But the regime didn't spare Abu Akleh, even at her funeral. Israeli troops attacked mourners carrying the slain journalist's casket outside the hospital, causing the coffin to almost fall to the ground. She was later laid to rest in a cemetery in occupied East Al-Quds. The journalist's killing and the subsequent attack during her funeral were met with international condemnation, with Israel's closest ally, the United States, calling it, quote, deeply concerning. The United Nations human rights experts have called the incident a serious attack on the freedom of media and expression and called for a transparent investigation. The case of the journalist is set to be brought to the International Criminal Court, a tribunal that has in the past attempted to probe Israel's rights violations and war crimes against Palestinians, but failed to do so due to political pressure and sanctions from the United States. Israel's aggression against countries like Syria and Lebanon has also been protested in the international arena. But so far, the reactions from the international community have been limited to verbal support. That begs the question, will Tel Aviv face any accountability for its crimes?
Within international courts, because who controls international courts? And who controls the International Criminal Court while they're not even a signer to it? That's U.S. imperialism. So I don't think Israel will be brought to any kind of justice or accountability through this, but I think it's up to the people of the world, it's up to all honest reporters, journalists, and news services to make sure that this does not go unmarked.
Some observers also ascribe the intensified Israeli pressure on Palestinians to some Arab states' moves to normalize ties with the regime. The Arab states had claimed that their decisions would help the Palestinian cause, an excuse that has repeatedly proven to be nothing more than mere window dressing over the past 2 years. Many Palestinians believe that in the absence of any international accountability, resistance remains their only way forward.
This is IRIB English Radio.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle.
Today's lesson, visiting our neighbors during illness. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of visiting neighbors and the rights of neighbors when they are ill, and we must visit them during their illness. This is one of the rights of the neighbors in the Islamic lifestyle. The Islamic lifestyle tells us, the Islamic teachings tells us, that if you want to have an Islamic lifestyle, you must be aware of your neighbors, of their condition. Maybe they are in need, so you can go and you can meet their needs. Because Imam Sajjad alayhi salam, he has said that one of the rights of the neighbors is وَلَا تُسْلِمُهُ عِنْدَ شَدِيدَ. Do not leave them on their own when they are in need, when they are in a trouble. So it is necessary to be aware of our neighbors. It is necessary to know about our neighbors so that we can help them. And on top of that, when the neighbors becomes ill, it is necessary to visit them. Why? Because when we are visiting our neighbors, it shows our sympathy with them. It shows that we care about the people who are living around us. We are social animals. And being the social animal, we must socialize with each other. And one of the ways of socializing with each other is to know about each other, to visit each other. And especially when a person is becoming ill or he is sick, so we are visiting him, because when people become ill, they become alone. And this is necessary, that being the neighbors, the first thing that we can do, or the least thing that we can do, is to go and visit them and to meet them and to show them that they are not alone, even if they are on the bed. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of visiting the neighbors when they are ill. And it is one of the ethics and rights of the neighbors according to the Islamic teachings. In the Islamic lifestyle, it is necessary to see our neighbors when they are ill, visiting them during the illness. Why? We said that the first reason is because people think that people are generally, when they are ill, when they are sick, they are alone, and no one goes to visit them. Therefore, we must go and visit them so that they come out of that loneliness, and they know that the people are, or our neighbors are, with us. Therefore, this is the first reason. The second reason why Islam emphasizes on visiting them during illness is that they might have a need. So when you go enter the house, or when you enter their house or go into their house, you will notice that maybe they do not have the medication, or maybe they have the medication and they need some other things. Maybe he is in need of food. Maybe the neighbor who is living next door. He is ill and he cannot cook anything for himself. He cannot prepare food for himself. Therefore, when we are visiting them, we are in a case like, or in a way, we are going visiting them and we are trying to know about their condition, the physical condition, and obviously the financial condition. And if they are in need, we can help them. Maybe for a couple of days, we can take food for them, which they want. Or maybe the doctor has prescribed something which they cannot prepare. Maybe the person who is ill, they do not know how to make a soup. And we can do that. We can make that and take it to them. Therefore, it is necessary to visit the neighbors while they are ill and to help them, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/en/call-of-islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Shia Muslims in Nigeria. Mahdi can now walk and perform many chores like fetching water for ablution to perform his 5 daily prayers. These were near impossible after the horror of the December 2015 Zaria massacre, where hundreds were murdered in cold blood. Hundreds like Mahdi received life-threatening injuries in the 3-day carnage. Walking for Mahdi was a torturous experience. Almost 3 years after the unbelievable horror, Mahdi still sits to vividly recall the atrocity. He was one of those shot and burnt alive by soldiers of the Nigerian army at Sheikh Zazaki's house in Gelesu in the northern Nigerian city of Zaria on December 13, 2015. Mahdi said he stayed without food for 72 hours and only survived because of the generosity of a good Samaritan who hid him away from the predators. During the carnage, Aisha was trapped in an upstairs building as intense shooting by the soldiers in Gelesu raged. Aisha said she survived by the grace of God. She had spent over 2 years treating bullet wounds on her leg. I apologize for making her recall the bitter experience.
An armed soldier will now go direct and face a private part of a lady and shoot, where grenades will be thrown to women to go and scatter their bodies. It happened. So it's a brutality that a heart will never imagine. And I will never like to see it again. The eye that saw it will never like to repeat it. It's very, very sudden.
It is totally condemnable. It is alien to our law. And it cannot be accepted. in any civilized society. More so that up till now, none of the murderers has been brought to book. Contrary to the recommendation of the Garba Judicial Commission for Inquiry and the white paper issued by the Kaduna State Government.
That on Saturday.
So Malama Amina Mustafa lost three children in the Zaria massacre. But above all, she lost her husband, who she said was a friend, a reliable confidant, and a responsible and loving spouse. Malama said she misses her husband every day. Back in 2017, during the International Quds Day rally in Kaduna, her surviving son, Hussein, was shot in the back by the Nigerian police. She said Hussein lost a lot of blood at the scene and eventually became paralyzed from the waist down. Hussein has since dropped out of school because none of the available institutions have infrastructural provisions for the fiscally challenged. She says caring for Hussein is a difficult task. Every day, Malama says she wonders at the viciousness of the Zaria massacre, especially the seeming absence of humanity in the perpetrators. Victims of the Zaria massacre live in many households in many cities in northern Nigeria. We visited many homes in Zaria and Kaduna. We moved from one house to the other, knocking on doors in the hope of listening to their accounts of what many described as the reprehensible crimes committed against their spouses, relatives, and friends. This is the family of Ibrahim Ahmed Badiko, who was killed in the Zaria massacre. He left 12 children and three wives. One of the wives was pregnant when he died. Now the children are 13 without a breadwinner. The Shuhada Foundation was conceived and established by the leader of the Islamic movement in Nigeria, Sheikh Ibrahim Zazaki, in January 1992. It is now headed by Sheikh Abdulhamid Bello, who says the main objective for setting up the foundation is to cater to the needs of the families of the martyrs who lost their lives during the struggle to establish the cause of justice.
And from time to time, the clamp down, you know, is increasing from time to time. So, but the worst one is what happened in this 2015, which we are registering almost 1,000 shuhada as a result of the clampdown by this Buhari administration.
Most organizations depend on assistance from donors. However, Sheikh Abdulhamid says the Shuhada Foundation has different ways of raising funds for taking care of the orphans and families of the martyrs.
We have what we call the Shuhada dues. We have it every, it has started by 5 naira. Every member of the movement will give monthly 5 naira as a due. So, but now it has come to 100 naira per month.
The Islamic movement holds the annual Shuhada Day in order to remember the contribution of the martyrs, to assess performance and to find ways of restructuring the organization for better performance. Most of these orphans are children of the hundreds of members of the Islamic movement killed in the December 2015 Zaria massacre. The Shuhada Foundation says the task of catering for their needs has become even more challenging.
Before 2015, we have less than 300 children.